Yo, what is going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Toys in every store. That's right, folks. The holidays are here, and this year they're saying they are here to stay. So we're here with the first of many Christmas episodes to come, talking Die Hard.
How many Christmas episodes are to come, Raymond?
Well, like I said, the holidays are here to stay. So an indefinite amount. I mean, but there's no shortage of them. And, you know, this is probably a hot take. I don't know if you guys have ever thought this or had it occurred to you. But Die Hard's kind of like a Christmas movie.
How dare you?
The debate is over. It's not even a thing. Obviously, this is a Christmas movie, so we don't even need to talk about whether it is or whether it's not. We're just going to presume that it is, and we're just going to kind of talk about the film. But of course, as you could have told by the intro, I'm Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We've got Raymond.
Hey, everybody.
And joining us is the lovely and wonderful and fantastic and intelligent and insightful. And we've had a lot of requests for her to come back, Amanda.
I feel like you're flattering. Thank you. Hello. Happy to be here.
And we will be talking about Die Hard. And the only question about whether or not this is a Christmas movie or not is this the greatest Christmas movie? So, I mean, I guess that's something that we could talk about.
It certainly has the greatest line in Christmas movie history.
Which is?
I shot a kid.
Well, I think last Christmas, didn't we do Bad Santa?
We did do Bad Santa last
Christmas. Wait, I think I did Bad Santa. Wait.
You were there with us. Wow. It's like a Christmas tradition.
This is a Christmas miracle.
Which is just so funny because I'm just a Jew.
I know.
You're not just a Jew.
Which I think gives me, I contain multitudes, but I am a Jew watching a Christmas film.
Do you celebrate Christmaka?
No, but the OC does have a very, very special place in my heart.
Yeah, that's me too. I mean, I'm from the OC, so, you know, like, it was the Coen family, you know. Yeah, in a lot of ways, very much so. So, but anyway, we're going to be talking about Die Hard, 1988, directed by Joe McTiernan. Do I have to say who it stars? Bruce Willis, Alan Rickman, Alexander Goodenough, Bonnie Bedelia, etc., etc. Let's go around. I mean, how do we even do a film that is so iconic like this, right? Let's go around. We'll talk about first impressions. What was it like the first time you saw it? What was it like revisiting it? How many times have you seen it? Where does this film, like, does it hold a place in your heart? If so, how big of a place does it hold in your heart? And is this the greatest Christmas movie ever made? Let's start with Amanda.
Okay. This is going to take me down a few pegs, but I'm going to be brutally honest. I had never...
Oh, no.
Seen it from start to finish consecutively. I had seen a lot of scenes. I knew the gist. I know it through osmosis. It was just somehow a gap. And I watched it twice for this podcast because I wanted to be really prepared. But it was like experiencing it for the first time because it kind of was. Except it was interesting, like, how much just being in, like, just being a member of the American culture, like, I already knew about it. But anyway, the point being, it's a ball. It's fun. It's interesting. I'm excited to talk about it. I think there's a lot going on in terms of, like, masculinity, 1980s America, feminist backlash-ish. And I also just think it's really interesting as an action film for, like, some of the little moments, like the cop getting pricked by the rose thorn, or like the terrorist, like, stopping to, like, eat some candy, like, it, or like the toe thing. There's just, like, a lot of little moments, like idiosyncratic moments, that give it this grounded feeling despite the absurdity that I feel like you don't really necessarily see in action film that much anymore.
And are they terrorists or are they just petty thieves, right? Common thieves, right?
That's true. Yeah, I shouldn't. By calling them terrorists, I am part of the problem. You're right. They're literally, they're just enterprising criminals.
There you go. That's right.
John Tunin has some thoughts on that we could get into, maybe.
Ooh, okay.
Amazing. Okay, Raymond, what about you, brother?
I can't remember the first time I saw this movie, because kind of like Amanda was saying, it just feels like it's part of, you know, blockbuster filmmaking's DNA at this point.
Yeah.
But I do remember as a kid, there was a Die Hard VHS tape sitting on top of the TV for what seemed like my entire childhood. And I don't think I ever once saw my dad watching it or anything. It was just the one movie he owned on VHS. And I remember then kind of picking it up and giving it the once over and seeing, you know, that the cover, or the, I think the VHS cover was basically the poster with the tower on fire, Bruce Willis's face and stuff like that. And it just looks so cool. You're just sitting there kind of like, yeah. Oh, what the hell is this? And then years go by, and I don't know if you remember the Die Hard arcade game in the 90s, there was a Die Hard arcade game that was just like a beat 'em up where you would go up the stories of Nakatomi Plaza. There were all these like weird things I remember about it, and this idea that I was forming of it in my head based on that video game was like, oh, it's a guy and he's got a friend that's a lady, and they just basically beat the shit out of everyone in a big skyscraper, and that's that. You know, not until years later would we get the Raid Redemption. But yeah, when I eventually did see it, whenever that was, I had then, on top of all that, received so much messaging about how it is the like ultimate action film. It's got humor, and it made Bruce Willis into a big star. And there had been multiple sequels to diminishing returns, and it just loomed so large for so long that I think by the time I finally saw it, despite knowing as much as I did about it, it still was exciting. It still felt fresh, and it's always a pleasure to rewatch. I probably watch it every other year or so, and I think the first couple sequels are really good as well. I just recently rewatched the second one because my roommate's obsessed with it, and I think that one's a hell of a time. I think this movie's a blast. There's a reason that it became the sort of gold standard in action filmmaking, and the one that everyone was ripping off for so long. Excited to talk about it.
Sick. So for me, I mean, I watched this as a kid growing up a lot. And then actually I hadn't seen it in like fucking 20 years since I was a teenager. So it was great to revisit. And especially now with my more critical lens, my years of like looking into, let's say, examining the structural unconscious of political, economic, and social economic and cultural motifs and structures and things like that. So it was really interesting to me. I was really taken aback, like Amanda mentioned, particularly about 1980s America. Immediately I was like, wait, so it's Nakatomi Tower, so it's Japanese, and in the 80s everyone thought that Japan was gonna like fucking take over America. So this is like the invasion of a type of empire, a corporate empire that's coming in. And so I think that's really important to understand that this building, what it signifies in terms of its own. And you know, that one guy, is it Harry, the guy that's the deal maker, that's like, look, we're all just, you know, fucking criminals here. Booby, you know, like that guy. they're like corporate raiders, but these people are like kind of like criminal, like non-legal, you know, not the black market, but sort of like the alternative market version. But I thought that was really important. And then of course the technology, I was really interested in technology, and I wish that I could have seen it in the theaters in the 1980s and been like, oh my God, these criminals are different. Like Hans Gruber isn't like big and bulky and hunky. I mean, he's got his henchmen, but he's smart. And he's strategic, and he uses a computer hacker. Like in the 1980s, would that not have been fucking terrifying? Would you not have been there like, oh my God, these criminals are so fucking smart. Not only do they have rocket launchers and crazy explosives, but they're also smart and techie and geeky, and it's like a new brand of criminal, and they're international. It's like this international syndicate, right? They don't have like a domestic cause. There's no way to get them. In philosophical terms, for all you geeks out there, if you know who Gilles Deleuze is, who also wrote some books on cinema, he and his co-writer talk about the rhizome as opposed to like the arborescent model. The arborescent model is like the tree, right? Where it's got like root system and then a trunk and then branches and leaves. The rhizome is just like it's got no center. It's totally decentralized. And these criminals to me sort of made me think of that. There's just like they could come from anywhere because they're anybody and nobody and all they want are fucking bonds, right? Like these government bonds, right? Worth $640 million, that's like billions of dollars today that they were stealing. So it's an insane amount of money. And so that was really interesting. And then also the fact that this corporation has these bonds, that's a really interesting economic. So there's a lot of like really cool economic things. Also like the fact that it's Bruce Willis, who was like from Moonlighting, who's the action hero. I love that. And he's funny. And he's a fucking cowboy. And I think this is also a story kind of like the Ballad of Cable Hogue, which is one of my favorite westerns of all time. Love me some Sam Peckinpah. This idea of like a man out of place, a man on the cusp of time, right? The old world versus the new world. And when he first gets introduced to this new world, it's this touch screen. And the guy at the front desk of Nakatomi Tower is like, yeah, if you go into the bathroom, it'll zip up your flyer. So it's again, it's about like this man from the old world who's like a gunslinger, no technology, no fluffs and frills. And he comes to California, which is like this weird place where he's being introduced to like the invasion of Japan, this Eastern corporate empire of technology. And I think there's some really interesting themes. And on top of that, it's so much fucking fun. It moves. I turned to my partner and I said, they just don't make movies like this. I know we say that all the time, but they just don't. And I don't know why. I don't know how. I don't know what the magic recipe is. But yeah, so I'm really excited to kind of tear this apart and talk about it with you all. But before we do, of course, we want to give a recap. But before I give the recap, I just want to give a shout to our Twitter. Make sure you follow us, SMTM_POD. We release like articles and things like that where we get a lot of our inspiration from, or we like refer to video essays and stuff like that of other people who are talking about the films that we address on the podcast. So make sure you follow us, SMTM_POD. Also, we are live. So if you're listening to us right now live on the YouTube chat, make sure you comment down below and we'll try to get to whatever comments we can throughout the discussion. If you're not listening live, but you want to listen live, make sure you pay attention to your notifications so you can come in and chime in live. And then, of course, make sure you check out other podcasts, Culture Binge, Squanch, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right, I'm going to go into a little bit of a recap here to refresh people's memories about this film. So, New York cop John McClane arrives to L.A. to visit his estranged wife and his children for the holiday season. Upon his arrival to LAX, he's greeted by a limo driver who was sent by his wife's ritzy Japanese employer, the Nakatomi Corporation. When he's dropped off at Nakatomi Tower, the limo driver, Argyle, offers to hang tight and wait for McClane and the fam. Once inside, McClane meets his wife and her colleagues while they're having a big old Christmas shindig. And shortly after, of course, while McClane is changing his clothes in another part of the building, all shit breaks loose, and a criminal enterprise led by the nicely dressed Hans Gruber busts the party and takes the employees hostage. And really what they're doing is they're seeking to get $640 million in bonds from the company vault. So they kill the executive Takagi after he fails to give them access, and then what they do is they sick their hacker Theo on the task to get into the vault on their own. Now, meanwhile, McClane starts taking out the henchmen one by one. He radios for police help, which leads to Patrolman Powell coming to investigate. Now, throughout the rest of the hijinks, McClane and Powell form a bond, with McClane being the eyes and ears inside, and Powell being support, and then relaying info to backup once they eventually do arrive. Eventually, the FBI shows up, they take over, and they want to take matters into their own formulaic hands, but all goes awry, and the baddies one-up the supposedly smart feds. So it's up to modern-day cowboy McClane to outsmart and outgun the slick criminal crew. By the end, a battered and bloodied McClane corners Gruber and takes him out with a hidden pistol trick. As Gruber falls backwards out the window, he grabs McClane's wife, Molly, and drags her with him, but McClane grabs her before Gruber any final moves.
It's Holly, yeah.
Holly. Well, then Holly, I wrote Holly once, and I wrote Molly another time, so it is Holly. Yeah, Holly Gennaro. and as Gruber's falling out the window, he grabs Holly. God damn it, I wrote Molly. It's Holly, goddammit. He grabs Holly and he pulls her out with him, but before Gruber can make any final moves, McClane unhooks Holly's fancy Rolex that she was just given by the company that Gruber was holding on to, leaving Gruber to plunge to his death. Also, I want to talk about this because I think that maybe there's something symbolically significant about the fact that the Rolex was unknown. Okay, anyway, in the end, John and Holly make up. Argyle drives them back to their fam. Powell gets his vindication, etc., etc. Everything is just nicely wrapped up in a shiny red Christmas movie bow. The end. Ho, ho, ho. All right, but before we continue, we got to give a shout out to our sponsor for this week's episode, Storyblocks. Look, y'all know the deal. Storyblocks is the complete stock solution, providing an unlimited library of over 1 million+ royalty-free, high-quality video, audio, and images through cost-effective subscription plans. I use Storyblocks, Wisecrack on the main channel, we use Storyblocks for all of our rad videos. And the really cool thing is that you get subscriptions, but they accommodate for every budget, and they've got this really cool initiative where they're really trying to proactively think about diversity and inclusivity in their content. So they're always changing the face of stock footage to help creators tell their own unique and authentic stories. So make sure that you go check out Restock, which is basically their commitment to increase representation in stock media by hiring creators from marginalized communities to make sure that they create content that is more reflective of their diverse world that we live in. So yeah, check all those goodies out at storyblocks.com/wisecrack. That's storyblocks.com/wisecrack, where you can learn all about what Storyblocks has to offer. Or of course, you can click the link down below. All right, back to the show. All right, so I'm a little curious to hear what McTiernan has to say about the baddies, Raymond. So, what does the director have to say about who these people are, and what is the kind of character dynamic going on here?
Well, I was kind of interested in just keeping this maybe not necessarily in my back pocket, but I thought maybe you had some notions about some political undertones. I think it bears mentioning that this movie positions like the American cowboy against Germans and somewhat against the Japanese in a way that he's like fighting against the Germans on Japanese territory. But I think a lot of that is just sort of coincidental because John McTiernan talks in the director's commentary on this about how, if you've read the book that this is based on, the Germans are just—they're just terrorists. I haven't read it, but I'm pretty sure they're holding folks hostage. He was talking about it in the context of this commentary. I was trying to sort of glean some details, but he said one of the major changes they wanted to make for the movie is that the terrorism angle is a little bit of a rope-a-dope. That they present as terrorists to cover up the fact that they're stealing these bearer bonds. And he even acknowledges in the commentary, he's like, yeah, it's a terrible plan. It doesn't make any sense that you would do that because terrorism is like a way worse thing to do than stealing bearer bonds or whatever. But he said the reason that they did that is that they wanted to make the villains kind of more palatable to the audience. And he kept saying he wanted to give that all the characters are always humming Ode to Joy while they're pulling off this heist. And he said he literally wanted to give a sense of joy to the movie, and he just didn't think that was possible if they were just, you know, just straightforward, run-of-the-mill bad guys. So instead, they kind of devised this this ruse so that you could not necessarily root for the bad guys, but that you would be able to stick with them from scene to scene without feeling, you know, icky for enjoying their exploits. So I'm curious what you guys think, just like from a one of the reasons I made note of it as I was prepping for this episode is this notion of like the death of the author. Do you think it's valid to read this film in a political context or whatever when John McTiernan himself has said like, oh, we went to great pains to try and make this as like as apolitical as possible?
I feel like it's that thing, right? Like everything's political, and trying so hard to make it apolitical, it almost made it like more political. Because because they were using terrorism, but they didn't have an ideology. So
yeah,
in some ways, they were just greedy. Like, that was it. So
which is the perfect criminal for neoliberalism, right? So it's almost like they unwittingly created the perfect villain for 1988.
For the Reagan era, you're absolutely right. So yeah, so in a weird way, it is still like very political. And it also, yeah, like they're in some ways just like a vibe. I mean, because like throughout the film, especially in the beginning, just like capitalism is treated as like we're not supposed to like these people who are having this big Christmas bash after celebrating a huge sale, and
yeah,
their contract, and he and Bruce Willis is so out of place because he's not like them. He's an everyman, and
yeah.
And everyone is just, and I mean, even with like the I forget his name, but the business guy who's like, I use a fountain pen, you use a gun. So in a weird way, it just aligned them with the sort of like gross materialistic like capitalism of the Reagan era.
Yeah, which is why I think the final shot that I was talking about, or one of the final shots with that Rolex being unclipped, it's like a critique of opulence, a critique of wealth, a critique of too much, because they focus on it, right? Like that business guy. What's his fucking name? We need to get his name. I keep thinking Harry, the booby guy.
Yeah,
he even says, like, when he's like, good, show him the watch, Holly. Mm-hmm. He's like, show him the watch. And he's like, it's a Rolex. Like, that's a big fucking deal. And obviously, they're expensive.
Harry Ellis. Yeah, it's Harry.
Okay, it is Harry. Yeah. And so I think it's really important that one, Gruber's holding on to it, that Holly's wearing it, and then when it gets unclipped, it's the cowboy, it's the blue collar, you know, it's the everyman from New York, the dirty streets of New York, you know, not the ritzy Upper East Side or whatever the fuck it is. I'm not from New York, so I don't know what the areas are. You know, it's the ritzy, gritty kind of guy, you know? What fucking Hell's Kitchen, Soho? I mean, where are ritzy spots in New York?
Brooklyn, Queens. I don't know. Queen, yeah. No, yeah, I mean, that's really interesting because I sort of read it, because like a lot of the film is about, or like the origin story of the film is about how kind of like his wife's ambition arguably tore apart the family, and the watch was like was symbolic of her success. And like, even though I feel like it was like, it's like a weird, not to go right from capitalism to gender, though obviously the two are intertwined, but like I feel like it's like a weird negotiation of like women's increased power in like 1980s like business world America. And it's like, because by the end, yeah, he is like, I should have been more supportive. You can go by your last name. But she's like, no, I want to go by your last name now because you're my protector. So it sort of is like a renegotiation of like the same kinds of like gendered nuclear family norms. And that was kind of how I read The Watch. But I also see your interpretation, and maybe it's both. Maybe it's neither. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, because we could say that there's like a lean-in feminism here. This woman who's a girl boss, right? Mm-hmm. And she gets this job. And this is the new world. And John McClane is a bit of he's a cowboy. He's a bit of an old world head. And, you know, maybe he could have and should have been more supportive of her aspirations to transcend, to do something more. Because there's that bit where they fight and he's like, she says like, I know what you wanted from a marriage, which I'm kind of taking that. I took that as like, you held me back. You wanted me to be like the stay at home, not the ambitious one. That's how I took it. Whereas she's like, I have ambitions. I have dreams. I have goals. So there's one sense where we can critique that and be like, yeah, but the way that her goals were played out in the context of the 1980s was this kind of like greedy pursuit of opulence and wealth with this, you know, this new technology company. Or we could say, on a more positive spin of that, that no, he should have been supportive because he's a bit kind of resistant and conservative, maybe holding her back. He should have been more supportive of her going and trying to kind of like make something of herself and you know, like not have a leash on her, so to speak, or something like that. So it's kind of an interesting, you can kind of look at it both ways. And I think that he kind of maybe is in the wrong. And then maybe that's what he means at the end when he's like, hey, I should have been more supportive. And then she takes the name. So is that kind of like a vindication of the old world? Or is that kind of like...
Yeah, that's how I saw it. It made me I cringed. Yeah. I full body cringed, to be honest.
Yeah. Just a side note. There was... Who was it? I think... Was it an influencer? They just got married and he took her last name. Have you seen this? That's caused like so much shit in the social media world.
Oh,
I can't remember.
That's such like viral bait of them.
That's
the ultimate intersection of like... That's like, that is lean in feminism. It's like, let's go super viral.
My partner and I were kind of like laughing because everyone, like, there's all these people that are just so upset that like a guy would take a woman's last name. Like, it is kind of funny that these things are still with us, right? That though, especially with like the name and the marriage thing, but that there's a history to it and there's like a power dynamic there. But yeah, sorry, I'm kind of getting off track now. But Raymond,
No. I think it's all on board, although none of us have any clue what's going on in influencer culture, whatever. But I do think there is a very like, even when I'm misremembering this, because I think they do the last name gag in Die Hard 4 with his daughter. His daughter is going by Gennaro. And I can't remember if it's his reaction in this one or that one, or if they're essentially the same. But when he sees that, it's kind of like, well, I knew to look for this, but it's still kind of a surprise, or at the very least, he sort of like scoffs and is dismissive towards it. But there is this sense of, you know, Amanda, you said like you full body cringed at that. I'm curious if the
if
notion
my mother
of her...
kept her last name. Yes.
No. I was gonna say at the end, the notion of her taking his last name, it's one of those things of like, does that read to you as an explicit rebuke of feminism, or does it more feel like, in the context of this movie, it's sort of a Chekhov's gun firing in a way of like, all right, they set this up, they pay it off, they've gone through something traumatizing, and maybe she feels safer with the notion of him being a, if not a financial provider, then like in the traditional rugged cowboy sense, like, oh, all of a sudden, you know, it's I'm proud to stand by my man a little bit more, because
Let me just add one thing too. This is after he destroyed her livelihood, though, because that company is no more.
I mean, that is, there's that. Yeah, no, definitely. To be totally clear, like, I don't think there's anything wrong with taking your partner's last name regardless of your gender. And like, you know, I have a horrible last name, Shirker. Like, so I understand the appeal for sending your last name. But I think it was like functioning as a symbolism. He was really irked by it. It meant that she was no longer acting as his wife. And then once he becomes the savior, reinstates himself as this like protector figure, the fact that that's the impetus for her to take his name back meant that she had taken her name, because he was like no longer her. You know what I mean? It added to the symbolism in a way that I actually think it would have been really cool and progressive and kind of rad if he had introduced her with her last name and she had been like, yeah, that's my last name now. And they were just like, okay, cool, we don't need
the
same last name.
And then she said, yippee-ki-yay, and then they rode into the smoggy sun.
So,
I don't think it's a rebuke of feminism by any means, but I think I think the Chekhov's gun is a good way of putting it.
There's another way to look at this in more of like a synthesis, like a kind of like dialectical synthesis. So if you have at the beginning her doing her thing, frustrated with him for being a bit of an old world head, him frustrated with her feeling like she kind of was like abandoning her marital responsibilities so she could kind of go off and do her own thing. But then what you get maybe with her kind of being like, okay, I take the last name again. That's a reconciliation. I'm willing to work now on the marriage and no longer be estranged. And then him kind of also being like, hey, I should be more supportive. And from now on, maybe he has like a level of self-revelation and he becomes a little bit more conscious. And now it's much more kind of like, okay, and now I will support you in those things. And so it's kind of like a both and. Like, that's a really charitable reading, but that's also one way to kind of look at this as well, you know?
I think it's too charitable because it's also like, it's based in like a very, like the entire idea of taking your husband's last name is based in such like a old world heteronormative patriarchal, like it just, that's the root of it. So I get what you're saying, but yeah, I don't know. It's still, it just rubbed me the wrong way, but.
Speaking of patriarchy, beyond the cowboy stuff, I was getting a lot of religious undertones with this watch. Where I'm curious y'all's thoughts on there are several times when they describe John McClane as, you know, the man upstairs. There's a scene where he's walking across broken glass and ends up with like stigmata in his feet. There are times when he's framed like angelically with fucking helicopter lights just blasting out from behind him. Like, all of this stuff is also just cool. But when you add to that the fact that this is a movie about like a Christmas miracle and like the rebirth of hope or whatever, there is a little bit of me where I'm like, oh, I don't know. Or do you think they're cognizant of this sort of messianic imagery that they're playing with, or is it just some happy accidents?
I have no idea, but I don't know if I like just hallucinated it, but at one point he fell backwards almost like in a crucifixion pose, and then he was like falling over like a weird couple of boards, and I was like, did I just imagine that? Because I feel like it had been incepted into my brain at that point that he was like this like Jesus figure almost. Yeah, so I think it's definitely there. I don't know how intentional, but it feels not accidental.
I mean, I think because we love to worship things that are bigger than us or people that are like superior than the everyday, you know, those types of things, like the shining lights and the bigger than life and the kind of the references, like there are a couple of references to God and to the man upstairs and things like that. And I think that those things kind of seep in, especially in an American culture where just religion is so part of the kind of public conscious psyche anyway, you know? So there's that. And then also I think there's really something like that final bit when he comes down and he sees Gruber and he's got Holly kind of like tied up. It's like he does kind of, you get the back lit. He does kind of remind me of like Jim Caviezel in The Passion, where he's just fucking bloodied and, you know, like bruised, and you're like, okay, is this a Jesus figure, you know? Or we could just say in just religious terms, monotheistic, you know, he could be any sort of messianic figure, Messiah Ben David or something like that.
Well, it's one of those things too that has so permeated the culture that like any, you know, for lack of a better word, any like deliverance narrative, you can very easily graft sort of hallmarks of religious mythology onto. But I, speaking of old-fashioned stuff, Mark Maurer in the chat is curious, if they don't make movies like this anymore, is it simply because they don't write books like this anymore? I think maybe a little bit reductive, but that did make me laugh, Mark.
I do want to say this. Like, remember last week we were talking about influences, and it was like the chain of influence. It's like, does it go back to like, you know, fucking Neanderthals, like in the cave and shit like that? Like,
yeah, you had the Towering Inferno and stuff like that.
And what we also have to remember that with the religious imagery that we're given in, for example, monotheistic texts, they're also drawing from other archetypes throughout history that preceded them. The hero, right? The hero, the savior, the someone that's going to come and deliver you, the redeemer. So those are the reason, like we oftentimes refer back, especially in the United States, we refer back to the Christian myth because it's just, what is it, like 30% of the population, so many people who founded the country. It's just so there, right? But we also have to remember that those religious traditions and that religious imagery and symbolism is also like just relying on a much more foundational human narratival structure about somebody coming in and saving our people from, you know, a situation beyond our control or something like that. So, you know, it's kind of, it's a very human.
Amanda disapproves of this line.
We lost Amanda.
Conversation.
We lost Amanda. If you're live right now listening to us on YouTube, we will kind of just bullshit for a minute until Amanda comes back, and we'll clean this up for the released version. But yeah, Raymond, do you want to BS for a minute?
No. I mean, I hear you on that stuff. I think, it's one of those we can talk about, like, what's that? What's the dumb book? Save the Cat, where they talk about, like,
yeah,
there are only like 10 or 12 stories ever, and virtually any story can be at its core can be reduced to the fundamental elements of one of those sort of story archetypes or story tropes. Die Hard being the, I think, as it would be described in Save the Cat, it's like a man with a problem. Okay, you know, I think to reduce it even further, I had heard a screenwriter years ago say something to the effect of, like, oh, well, there are many stories, but there's really only one plot. And that one plot that every single movie is about is something's wrong. That's the whole plot. With this one, I think there's a little bit more to it, at least in my estimation, than A Man with a Problem or an updated take on Western mythology or even Christian mythology. But I kind of like reading this as just a story of, like, essentially one man going to the ends of the earth in order to, like, just keep his family together. And that this movie could very easily just be like, oh, I don't know, Kramer versus Kramer. But it's like, rather than the family courts being the obstacles in this way, it's like a fucking burning building and a bunch of terrorists.
Yeah. Are there any movies where they intentionally try to do a different story? There's nothing wrong? And, like, kind of just nothing happens?
Where there's nothing wrong?
Yeah.
And nothing happens. I mean, I don't know. Like, there's tons of experimental stuff, but as,
like,
far as
the mumblecore films kind of try to do that, but even then, it's
not
like
necessarily.
They're like,
that's still,
yeah, it's
about,
like, real subtle.
Yeah, and those are still very much grounded in, like, very base or human or emotional wants and desires. Like, that, I think if you watch a lot of those, and this is not me saying, like, oh, you know, great, but it's one of those things that's like, okay, if take the first one that comes to my mind is, like, Baghead, that the Duplass brothers did, which I think is a really fun movie. And it's about a group of friends who decide that they go to a horror film festival. They see a horror movie and they go, well, we could do that. And then they go out into the woods and they're trying to come up with a story for their horror movie. And then in the course of trying to come up with it, two of them devise a scheme to scare the other ones and just tape their reactions and just go from there. And it's like, do they have a problem? No, but they do want something. And I would say, like, 99.9% of movies starts with just a character wanting something. And then the movie is just about what they're willing to do in order to get that thing. I don't know. I mean, there's, you bring up mumblecore. I think one of the progenitors of mumblecore would be Richard Linklater. You see his DNA in a lot of those sort of prosumer digital experiments. And, you know, when I think of, like, Everybody Wants Some or, you know, Dazed and Confused, those two companion pieces in his filmography, I don't necessarily know that I would say there's anything wrong in there. But, like, when you wake up in the morning, Austin, is there stuff that's, like, wrong in your life? And
I'm hungry.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it just comes down to, like, objectives and tactics.
Exactly.
The
just
notion.
Wants, it's a want in relation to a lack, right? And sometimes the lack determines the want. And, I mean, maybe it depends on what you believe philosophically, psychoanalytically. But yeah, like, I wake
love
up
our
and
Die
I don't
Hard
have food
episode,
in my belly.
The most, like, clear obstacle tactic movie ever made has devolved into one of our Patreon discussions about, like, what even is a story?
Yes, what it is, exactly. let's talk about a little bit. We're still waiting, everybody, for listening to Amanda. And because this conversation is meaty, we're going to kind of just keep fucking talking. And then when Amanda comes back in, we're going to let her have her stage for a minute. But I was just going to shift tack and talk about like this as like a Western.
Yeah,
like and the Western elements, cowboy elements.
I was going to say to kind of get back on track. Aman Ahmad in our chat just mentioned. Do you know how the Fast and the Furious is basically the same film as Point Break? What is the corollary to Die Hard? There has to be one. Aman, that's a good question. And apologies if I mispronounce your name, but there are so many movies after Die Hard was a huge hit that were explicitly pitched as like. It's Die Hard, but on a boat. It's Die Hard, but on a bus. Like I just described Speed 2 Cruise Control and Speed 1 Regular Control. And I mean, this one definitely has such a big cultural footprint. But I do think before, Austin, to come back to what you were saying, we discussed Escape from New York on this podcast. You can see a little bit of that, if not exactly... Escape from New York's influence on something like Die Hard, but the kind of movies that John Carpenter was obsessing over, you can imagine John McTiernan doing the same. That, you know, this is kind of cut from the same cloth as Austin. You referenced the notion of John McClane being sort of a man out of time, a man out of his own era at this point, or who has outlived his usefulness and is able to, you know. Be as good once as he ever was, even if he's not as good as he once was. And you know, that's fucking John Wayne's late career. That's The Searchers. You know, there are definitely or Rio Bravo is another great example. Although I don't think the story structure of something like this really correlates as much with a Rio Bravo as it might with The Searchers or Escape from New York. But what do you guys think?
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, look, he's for sure like the lone cowboy figure. He's like very explicitly like coded as blue collar right down to like the muscle tank in a world that's like very clearly like materialistic and modern and scary and not what he's used to. And he has to rely like every institution is a complete disaster to the point where the cops don't even hear gunshots and don't even like see that as cause for alarm, right? And so so it's like I think it's a classic Western in terms of like breakdowns of institutions, and the lone individual with like a good head on his shoulders has to save everybody.
Yeah, and he's the man of violence that comes from the mean streets, right? Like, he's talking about how he's got this backlog of criminals, 6 months, da-da-da-da. His captain back there is always trying to tame him. He's the wild, right? You know, and then he comes here to this domestic California. And he mentions that multiple times, like, Jesus Christ, California, basically, right? But it's this world of corporate suits, technology, things are in place. The one guy, the bad guy, you know, says, like, there are things you can't do as a cop, right? So again, there's the rules, but he is the man outside of that. And he uses violence to create a civilization, to create a world, right? The question is, though, is can he stay? And this is I love the book. It's called Six Guns in Society. It's basically about Westerns. It's a great book, kind of like a sociological analysis of the Western as an American myth. And one of the things that I can't remember the author's first name. Is it Wright? Is it Ronald Wright? It's W-R-I-G-H-T. I can't remember. And he talks about how like the man of violence in the classical Western kind of formula comes in but can't stay, which is why at the end of Searchers, John Wayne can't come into the house, which is why it's Shane, he rides off on the horse, which is why in Logan, you know, which is basically just a retread of all of these kind of Western ideas, Logan has to die, right? The man of violence uses the violence to create the world and create a semblance of peace, but is not allowed in that world.
I think I mentioned one of my favorites last week, Monty Walsh as well. High Noon, says Peter Crooker in the chat, you know, a lot of great examples.
Yeah.
What was
so
the question?
So then if Bruce Willis, if he's attacking this new technological, economic, corporate entity and it gets destroyed, after Happily Ever After, what happens?
Like, they're bi-coastal.
That's right. Do they have an agreement and they kind of like, you know, half the time in New York?
This movie is a little bit of a sitcom, or rather this movie series is a little bit of a sitcom, because after each one, despite whatever resolution they've reached, by the beginning of the next one, it's like, eh, we're on the outs again. They just have to like keep resetting his relationship dynamic. And I mean, on one hand, that's lazy screenwriting, but on the other hand, it's like, well, yeah, it kind of tracks with the person that we perceive him to be within this narrative, that like, as you said, Austin, whether he can't be tamed, or maybe there's a far less romantic way of describing it. I know watching this movie, it's one of those things that's kind of like, it's such a bummer to watch the fourth and fifth ones, especially because you watch this. It's similar to watching the fourth Indiana Jones, where you go from like, oh, I want to be Indiana Jones, or I want to be John McClane or whatever. And then you go to like, oh, I don't think Indiana Jones even wants to be Indiana Jones anymore. And Bruce Willis definitely doesn't want to be John McClane anymore. But there's a weird, like, what I think is so great in this one, and one of the reasons I think it sort of catapulted him into action stardom, despite the fact that his bona fides up until this point were, like, you know, TV acting, and he's like a more traditional... Yeah, romantic leading man, is that like he seems approachable. He's like, I love the beat at the beginning where he sits up front with Argyle, because it's just like, no, I don't feel good sitting in the back, because that makes me feel like I'm in charge of you or whatever. Like, they do this great stuff to kind of communicate how down to earth he is, and I think that pays dividends when you start watching the movie and he starts getting into really big trouble. It's like, it makes him fallible in a way that, like, by the fourth movie doesn't really seem to be the case.
And I feel like that's also just indicative of like how action movies have changed, as not like a huge action movie buff, but I feel like you don't see a ton of action films where by the end the character is as like bloodied and like on the verge of like death as this character seems to be. And like, he takes his hits and then they have consequences. Like, that's why I keep coming back to like the foot thing, like the fact that he's barefoot the entire time because he was doing that foot thing to get grounded after being on a plane because he was scared. Like, it definitely. And then I also, that's why like the masculinity element of the film is really interesting, because like at one point he even like yells at the police officers, he's like, these fucking macho guys who are like, you know, about to like storm the building, which is like not, because I feel like his brand of masculinity is less like brute force and more like smarts and like intuition and it's just more like subtle or nuanced, maybe. And sorry, I went off on a rant.
Yeah, no, this is great, because, you know, they don't have like Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger, like these gods in male form just walking around. You know, they've got a guy who's vulnerable, who's got a big fucking scar on his shoulder from like a botched surgery from when he was a kid, where you're like, oh shit, this is a real person, right? Like, and he's not super ripped, and you know, he's got like nice chest hair coming out and stuff like that, and you're like, this is like a dad, you know. He's got a little bit, like, he's obviously in okay shape, but he's got a little bit of a dad bod, you know. He's not like fucking chiseled out of stone. And then you've got the FBI who come in with their rigid tactics. They've got the machines, and then you get the one guy that's like, it's just like being
Robert
back in
Davi.
Fucking Nam.
Yeah, he's a fucking exactly. Psycho.
Yeah, he's like the old world kind of cliche predator type of masculinity that you might see, you know, like in the films Predators, where it's just like bulging fucking muscles and they're like, we're gonna fucking, you know. And it's you get a vulnerable hero with Bruce Willis, and there is something kind of lovely. And I love what you said, Amanda. I think it's necessary that he's not just using brute strength too, not only because he has compassion and family concerns, and it allows him to come to that self-revelation at the end, but also he has to outsmart this new stock of criminal. Like, you can't just match them gun for gun, because that's these guys are smart and they use technology. So you have to have a little bit of, like, you have to meet them
kinda
where
have
they
to play
are.
Their game a little bit,
yeah. It, rather than just being like the top down formula, which is what the feds were trying to do.
And I do just want to say, someone in the chat called me out. That one account, 931, said the relationship isn't reset in the second one. Holly's on an airplane. The airport is being taken over by terrorists. Then their relationship is reset to a bad one by the third film. Well observed, that one account, 931. I apologize. I just, like I said, I just rewatched the second one. And that totally slipped my mind. But there is a B plot that the plane is running out of gas and they can't land it, so they keep having to do loops. And Holly's up there just like trying to help everyone keep calm and stuff. Very, very fun movie. But all apologies. I will atone. Please don't put coal in my stocking.
Yeah. Amanda, do you have any other? Because Raymond and I had a chance to babble for a minute while your computer died. Do you have anything? Can we give you the spotlight for a couple minutes? Do you have anything special that you took in notes, or more things that you want to bring up that we can kind of chew on?
Okay. To go back to the thing we weren't going to talk about. Why do people debate whether this obvious Christmas film is a Christmas film? And from my perspective, I think it's because, like, Christmas isn't necessarily coded as, like, very masculine. And if you think about Christmas films, they're very much centered, like, in the domestic. And they're about, like, forgiveness and charity and mercy and and this one is not that. And I think it's like there's maybe an incompatibility with, like, even the, like, I know I'm maybe contradicting myself a little bit because I said he's not brute force masculinity, but he's still, like, there's like a ruthless out, like, he fucking kills every single terrorist. Like there's no, you know, taking prisoners. So I feel like that it's like a cognitive dissonance. And that's been like the source of the debate, is that we're not used to seeing, like, it's hard for us to reconcile Christmas with this sort of like brutal masculinity. That's just a thought.
Until, of yeah. course, Jingle All the Way.
And then you get Schwarzenegger himself.
Schwarzenegger and the silver screen's most masculine icon, Sinbad, fighting over an action figure.
Well, it's interesting. So if we take the Christmas thing, in America, under like a consumerist, materialist approach, it's about like buying and giving gifts. And this film is all about like wealth and greed and like the exchange of things or acquiring things, right? And you kind of then get a family story that really drives everything. Is Bruce Willis is just, he's going out to see his family, and in the end he gets the best Christmas gift of all, which is he gets reconciled with his family. So absolutely, at the surface level, it doesn't seem like it, but there's also a real sort of like holiday season kind of heart that's about family and showing up for your kids and, you know, reconciling for your mistakes and, you know, those times of reflection that kind of like cause you to stop in your busy everyday lives.
But Amanda, to your point, it's also not just John McClane that, like, in the context of this film is being valorized for adopting, you know, cinema friendly expressions of masculinity, we'll call them, but even like the character Al Powell, whose entire character arc is got demoted because he shot a kid, by the end of the movie the way that he like gets his groove back is by learning how to shoot people again,
to shoot a human in, yeah.
instead of like following through on the trauma that he surely has like not only inflicted on others, but has internalized himself, and the way that that has maybe changed him as a person and possibly made him more self-reflective. It's like, fuck that. The way you get your mojo back is you pull that motherfucking trigger, Al.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I mean, fucking Holly Jolly, am I right?
It is Holly Gennaro Jolly.
Do you think it's this tension? I mean, we're totally speculating here unless you've read reviews that say this explicitly, but do you think that maybe this is why the film was kind of released to mixed critics? And some people actually criticized Willis's performance, and it's because he wasn't like the standard action hero, and maybe they had a hard time accepting that he was this more vulnerable guy because of his comedic past. And like, is it a Christmas movie? Is it not a Christmas? It's an action film, but it's a weird action. There's a lot of violence. Like, there were a lot of critiques about this when it first came out.
Yeah, I think it's like, I think it defies categorization to some degree that maybe confuses people in our like branding obsessed Hollywood mindscape, where we're like, we're walking in knowing exactly what to expect, and anything that deviates is unacceptable.
Well, I also think it maybe bears mentioning that at the time, I think a lot of critics saw this as sort of like the ultimate expression of Hollywood excess. Even if, you know, maybe over the past hour we've been making the argument that it might be critiquing that excess, or it may just be a product of that excess that seems quaint in retrospect because our blockbusters have gotten so much more excessive now. But I can see how folks maybe watch this, and I also think that not all critics, but some film critics who maybe were tastemakers of the time, had a notion that, like, well, this very type of movie, in much the same way that people look down their nose at all horror because they judge it by the worst type of horror, maybe they just characterize this as the worst type of action, and they don't have any kind of like way of differentiating that just because it is within this sort of ghettoized genre that they're going to write it off or dismiss it lightly. But who knows? There is one question in here. Aman Ahmad jumped in and asked if the casting of Bruce Willis in Die Hard perhaps opened the door to Michael Keaton in Batman. I know based on Tim Burton and Michael Keaton's history working together, when they made Beetlejuice together, going into Batman, Tim Burton lobbied him for him pretty hard. I think that Warner Brothers kind of wasn't so sure about it, but I think that maybe there's something there, but more so I think that Tim Burton making a hit movie with Michael Keaton probably opened the door for Michael Keaton and Batman. Also, I think Michael Keaton is such a great choice for Batman because he's just fucking off. And I think a lot of other adaptations of Batman miss the point that he's a fucking psychopath. And I think Michael Keaton's really great at getting that aspect of the character.
Yeah. What do we think? Final thoughts here before we jump into the mailbag. Amanda, anything you want to say about your first experience watching Die Hard? And are there any amazing Hanukkah films that we need to be paying attention to here that fly under the radar with like the deluge of Christmas media that we often refer to?
Oh my God. I don't think I can think of a single Hanukkah film, much less a single good one.
Crazy Nights.
Home for Purim is fun, but that's about a spring holiday. Yeah, it's, but you know, I mean, Hanukkah isn't that big of a holiday. It just became a big holiday because Jewish kids wanted to not be sad about missing Christmas. Like, it's not that actually important, like in the context of Judaism. So, no, there are not. Final thoughts on my first start to finish experience, uninterrupted. Yeah, just like a fun, interesting portrait of a moment in American history that I think in a lot of ways is like reflective about that moment, and in other ways like not that self-aware. And I think like an interesting action film that, like you guys said, like set the precedent for future action films that would almost invariably not be as interesting as it was. So I think it's like, as weirdly enough as mainstream it is, I think it's like something of an oddball.
Raymond, what about you, brother?
I mean, just off of what Amanda was saying just now, it is kind of odd to look back at this movie at this point. It reminds me of, I mentioned Indiana Jones earlier, and Spielberg and George Lucas talked about how when they made Indiana Jones, one of their sort of North Stars in the writing and development process was this notion that they were going to make a movie with all the boring bits cut out. And they were like, can we write a movie that's only the good bits? And Indiana Jones rules, but if you watch it now, it feels like an art film in a way. Like, it's similar to this, where these may be, like I said before, they may be the utmost expressions of cinematic excess for their time, but it is like you said at the beginning of the show, Austin, it's kind of a bummer that they don't make them like they used to, at least not as often. I think John Wick is a great exception to the rule there. Those movies rule. I mentioned The Raid Redemption earlier. Fucking phenomenal action series. One other thing I would mention that for some great context about like positioning this movie within the context of its time, both politically and culturally, Amanda and I were talking a little bit before we went live. There's a really good commentary on, I think it's like the 40th anniversary DVD, but I'm sure the commentary has been reused on the Blu-rays and stuff as well, that shuffles between a track that was recorded by John McTiernan and a track that was recorded by Jackson DeGovia, who was the film's production designer. And he specifically talks a lot about the design that went into Nakatomi Plaza and how he was drawing from stuff of that era in trying to create like the backstory of not only these characters, but the corporation and what influenced that. I mean, it's definitely a movie that feels like it feels timeless in its narrative structure, but it's also a very cool little kind of time capsule of like you said, Reagan era excess and how that has not only changed upon reflection, but also affected movies going forward.
I love that. This is like my favorite way of analyzing a film, is looking at it as a cultural artifact, right? And when you're in the midst of it, kind of like when you're swimming in the midst of life in the present, we're often not aware of kind of the broader picture, the context, the sociopolitical, the kind of like gender relations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's only in hindsight, or stepping outside of the context, or listening, or kind of looking through the eyes of the other, that you can get sort of a richer perspective. And sometimes time is kind of like the perfect othering process. And I love doing this. So just for people who are out there like wondering, like, how do you get started? Like, I actually remember listening to people talk about films in this way when I was younger. And I was like, how do they even, I was like, I just don't think in those ways. And I want to, and I actually had to work. I had to struggle. Like, I would listen to fucking Slavoj Žižek do like psychoanalytic critiques of film. And I'd be like, I just don't get it. Like, how do you get into that kind of thing? And I think one of the really helpful ways is just starting by, exactly like Amanda and Raymond were just saying, is think of the film as a time capsule or a cultural artifact or a snapshot of a moment, and then start looking at that moment and start thinking, oh, what influences, kind of unconscious influences, maybe formed the background. So as much as McTiernan tried to depoliticize, in what ways did he unwittingly politicize in another way, right? Those kinds of things are really interesting and helpful. And and like I said, if you got more questions on this, please feel free to email us, movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. We can also, you can call us at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. And you can leave us a voicemail. And maybe this would be great for a Patreon episode in the future for us kind of talking about like media criticism, film criticism. How do we approach a film?
What is it?
You know, what are some good resources? Exactly. But yeah, but real quick, I did want to just say that we got a couple of emails and we got a voicemail. We don't know who it was from and it kind of was cutting in and out about Whiplash. We'll try to kind of like address some of those things maybe in the future. They were about like the relationship between sports and passion and desire. I think a lot of people were kind of like, oh, that's a really cool way of looking at Whiplash as a film about like music excellence or obsession towards greatness, but how that kind of like maps on to other pursuits, one namely being sports, which is something we talked about in the episode. But so just so you know, keep the stuff coming in. We're not going to address it just because we're kind of running up against the time here, but we did get all that stuff, so make sure you keep flooding us with your comments. You can again email us movies@wisecrack.co or call us 1-213-534-8807, and make sure to follow us on Twitter, smtm_pod. All right, let's get out of here. Where can people find you on the internet, Amanda?
I tweet like once every 6 months at Amanda Shirker.
Amazing. And Raymond, what about you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria. And if you still have the Christmas spirit after listening to this podcast, I would recommend another wonderful podcast episode. Our friends over at When Cinephiles Attack did an episode on the Muppet Christmas Carol last week. That is one of the funniest podcast episodes I've heard all year long. Happy holidays, everyone. Austin, what about you?
Hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden, Insta, AOS_HAY. I've got a philosophy podcast called Owls at Dawn. After a long hiatus, we are back. Two new episodes will be dropping before the end of the year and back to regularly scheduled programming. Send us out of here, Raymond. Let's go.
Goodbye from Nakatomi Plaza, booby.